to welcome you to Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is exploring carbon fees and the Clean Air Act regulations. What does regulatory pause really mean? At this point, I'd love to welcome our speaker tonight. It's none other than the wonderful Dr. Ross Astoria. Professor Astoria teaches political science and law at the University of Wisconsin, where he's been recognized as an outstanding educator by Delta Kappa. He's recently completed a chapter on greenhouse gas mitigations and utility law for a forthcoming Oxford University Press book. Ross is also a group leader for CCL Racine Kenosha's chapter and has recently published on other aspects of international trade and greenhouse gas mitigation. And for tonight, if we've done our job well, you will be walking away with three main goals: a review of the history and regulatory architecture of the Clean Air Act, the chance to understand a bit more about where to find and begin interpreting the EPA regulations governing greenhouse gases, as well as an understanding and ability to evaluate the interaction of those regulations with legislation like the Energy Innovation Act and how that really interacts and intersects with those regulations. To do that, Ross is going to go through a five-fold agenda. He'll do a quick review of administrative law, then transition to a review of the Clean Air Act's history and framework. We'll talk more specifically about some of the EPA greenhouse gas regulations and then dive into the pause within the Energy Innovation Act's legislation. And then from there, talk about an evaluation framework for larger carbon pricing legislation and how that might interact with regulations. Without further ado, though, I'll pass it to you, Ross. I'll make sure that you're unmuted, and thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you, Brett, and thank you all for being here. Let's take a look at how administrative law works at a pretty high level, and we'll get into what I call the architecture of the Clean Air Act, and I think you could do this with just about any bill. Ask about what its architecture is and kind of abstract from the particular language. So one way to think about how a bill comes about and how a bill operates with the administrative state is a policy coalition develops, and we at Citizens Climate Lobby, this is what we're doing. We're trying to put together a coalition that will get a bill passed through the Congress. And usually those bills, our bill might end up being a little different, but a lot of those bills are what I call enabling statutes. That is, they give some general direction to an administrative agency, and then they leave it to the administrative agency to implement the broad policy goals of the statute. So the Federal Power Act tells the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to make sure prices are just and reasonable, and the Clean Air Act says administrative environmental protection agency keep the air clean. There's more detail than that, but then the administrative agency tries to follow those instructions. And so what happens here with an enabling statute is the administrator of the agency, in our case the EPA, will look at the language of the statute and say, okay, I have to do this and that. I have to issue national ambient air quality standards, or I have to issue water standards, or I have to issue standards for engines. And then what the administrator does is takes that language and then issues the regulations after a process of notice and fact-finding and a whole bunch of work to make sure that those regulations match up with the statutory directions. And the courts in our system supervise the administrative agency's implementation of the statutes. And in particular, the type of judicial challenge that we often see here to administrative rulemaking is an ultra vires challenge, and ultra just means beyond, and vires means power. So an ultra vires power challenge is basically a challenge saying the administrative agency has gone beyond its power in implementing these statutory rules. They're not allowed to do this by the Clean Air Act or by the Federal Power Act or something like this. Another type of challenge here, which I usually say more about, but the Congress is limited in the type of statutes that it can pass by the Commerce Clause and the Tax and Spend Clause, and that's important to keep track of. But I think Brett will move on and not say too much more about the constitutional challenge here, and we'll talk about the architecture. So the Clean Air Act is an enabling statute, and it tells the Environmental Protection Agency to do certain things. And a couple key distinctions that the Clean Air Act makes is the distinction between mobile sources, trucks, automobiles, and stationary sources makes that distinction. And so on the mobile side, one of the impulses for this distinction is the different states at the time of the Clean Air Act passage were starting to implement their own standards for automobiles, and in particular, California was taking the lead here, and kind of regulating engines and energy efficiency and for its automobiles, and the automobile industry was not interested in having 50 different regulatory frameworks for its engines. So what the bargain here was that the auto industry would support the Clean Air Act on the condition that it, quote, preempted, and that's our legal term, it preempted state regulations of automobiles. And the Clean Air Act, however, made one exception to that general preemption, and then that is it allowed California to continue implementing its own regulations of automobile standards. And then there's the stationary sources. The stationary sources is the stuff that doesn't move. So that's the coal-fired power plants, the natural gas plants, and the different factories. And there are, so that's a good enough distinction there. The other distinction that's very important here for understanding the regulatory pause is the criteria pollutants and national ambient air quality standards. And I'll say more about that in the next slide. But the third architectural point here is the Clean Air Act made a distinction between existing and new sources with respect to stationary sources. And the gambit here was basically we're going to put higher standards on the new sources than existing sources. And the hope in terms of if this was founded in not just politics but in good policy, the hope was that as those existing facilities kind of depreciated and retired, they would just be replaced with new sources that had the latest and greatest technology, right? So the Clean Air Act places higher standards on new sources than on existing sources. And that distinction will show up when we look at greenhouse gas regulations. But an important note for us as climate advocates is basically, utilities didn't shut down their existing sources. So rather than letting them depreciate out of existence and then be replaced with new sources, they've kept them running and running and running as long as they possibly could, basically evading putting new controls on their plant. And this ends up, I think, being a really good opportunity for us as climate advocates because it means a lot of the existing plants out there are old and depreciated and ready to be turned over. So it's depreciated capital because of this distinction. So I don't think this distinction makes a lot of sense, it turns out, but we have an opportunity here to get that old plant off the grid pretty quickly, I think. Fourth point here is the point of federalism and cooperative federalism. So the way the Clean Air Act works is it tells the Environmental Protection Agency to set national ambient air quality standards, basically how much particulate matter can be in the air, and then it kicks it off to the states to do state implementation plans that meet those that meet those standards. So let's take a quick look at the criteria pollutants on the next slide, I think. All right, so here are the criteria pollutants. And these, to my mind, this is basically the gunk that when it gets in your lungs, it makes you have asthma and other stuff. So carbon monoxide is a poison. Lead causes neurological damage. Carbon dioxide, ozone destroys biological matter. Particulate matter is a criteria pollutant of two sizes, 2.5 microns and 10 microns, and then sulfur dioxide. One point about particulate matter that caught my attention is the various statistical studies will show you that there is a high correlation between particulate matter in the air and heart attacks. And it took me a while to figure out why this was so. I can understand why particulate matter would cause asthma attacks and this sort of thing. But that particulate matter of 2.5 microns is actually so small that when you breathe it in, it goes into your body through the alveoli. And so if you have a blood clot or anything, that particulate matter is in your blood now, and it will nudge that blood clot towards death. And so the criteria pollutants here, that's basically the stuff when you breathe it, it does bad things to your body. And then our last line here, greenhouse gases. What about these things? Carbon dioxide, and methane in particular, how do they fit into the picture? We have an ultra vires challenge here under the Clean Air Act. And so in the late 90s, 1997, I believe, the Clinton administration, its EPA, started winding up theories under which it could use the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. There was some internal debate with the EPA about how to do that. The Bush administration took over, and somewhat curiously, climate advocates here are maybe a little pessimistic on the Bush administration, but there were some strong advocates of carbon dioxide regulation in Bush administrations, Whitman out of New Jersey in particular. So using the Clean Air Act and the presidency had some potential here in the beginning of the 2000s. So petitioners then, once the Bush administration took over and it looked like there wasn't going to be any action, some petitioners, including some environmental groups in Massachusetts and some states, petitioned the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide. The EPA declined. And after they declined, those petitioners then became litigants and they sued the EPA with an ultra vires challenge. And they looked at Section 202 of the Clean Air Act, and that section says the EPA administrator shall prescribe standards applicable to the emissions of any air pollutant which contributes to air pollution which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. So those petitioners who became litigants argued that carbon dioxide is an air pollutant which is reasonably anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. All right, so here's the statutory text of the Clean Air Act that the Supreme Court looked at when it made its decision as to whether or not under that language carbon dioxide was a pollutant. And here the Clean Air Act says the term air pollutant means any air pollutant agent or combination of such agents, including any physical, chemical, biological, radioactive substance or matter which is emitted into or otherwise enters the ambient air. So that's a convoluted set of words, but I would call that a capacious definition of air pollutant. And so you're kind of looking at this, you're a climate advocate, and you're like, well, you know, carbon dioxide, that's a physical substance. It is a chemical substance being entered into the ambient air. And a court looks at that language about carbon dioxide, air pollutant, says carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and hydrofluorocarbons are without a doubt physical and chemical substances which are emitted into the ambient air. The statute is unambiguous. And I like highlighting that term unambiguous because the Massachusetts versus EPA comes out in 2007, which is roughly a decade after the EPA has started looking at its Clean Air Act authority as to whether or not it could use that to regulate carbon dioxide. And it took 10 years to make a declaration that those substances are, for purposes of the Clean Air Act, pollutants. 10 years to get to unambiguity. So the take-home point here is now carbon dioxide and those other greenhouse gases are pollutants for purposes of the Clean Air Act. And here's just a little timeline of what happens once, what happens once the court finds that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. So some reference points here, 1997, Senate rejects Kyoto. The petition for rulemaking that I just talked about began in 99. EPA denies that petition in 2003. The litigation begins, takes 4 years to conclude the litigation. 2008, McCain and Obama both campaign on a cap and trade program. 2009, Waxman-Markey passes the House and the EPA comes out with what's called the endangerment finding. Cap and trade fails in the Senate in 2010. And then what is sometimes called the stepwise regulation or the cascade of regulation on carbon dioxide begins. So in 2011, the EPA, in conjunction with the National Transportation Safety Administration, that's not quite right, but that's close enough, they issue their CAFE, their joint CAFE standards and tailpipe standards. The fuel efficiency standards on automobiles are jointly issued by the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency under its authority to issue corporate average fuel economy standards. Those were issued in conjunction with the EPA's regulatory authority over greenhouse gases. And the backstory here is that the short of it is GM about went bank did go bankrupt because of the financial crash. And the agreement to those mobile sources in 2011 basically put the national standards at California standards in exchange for a bailout. Probably the folks at GM are getting angry at me about that, but that's basically the short of it. In 2013, the EPA comes out with its new source stationary standards. So remember, one of the distinctions between built into the Clean Air Act is between existing standards and new sources. So those regulations in 2013 are standards for new sources from electrical generating units, EGU. And the short of it is those standards are such that new natural gas plants could meet them, but coal-fired power plants can meet them only if they had carbon capture and sequestration on them. All right, so that's the standards for those. And then existing sources are issued and begin the promulgation in 2015. And that's the Clean Power Plan. And we'll do an analysis of the Clean Power Plan, even though it's not much with us at this moment, but that ends up being one of the things that is traded. All right, so first thing, when we talk about the regulatory pause in the Energy Innovation Act, Section 11 of the Energy Innovation Act says no preemption of state law. So when we spoke about the Clean Air Act and mobile sources last time, we said the Clean Air Act preempted state standards on mobile sources except for California. And here, the Energy Innovation Act says no preemption of any state law. And so let's take a look. Oh, look at that. We've got the legislation up there. Looks all nice and Congress ready. So Section 11, so just a list of some of the stuff that will be retained. So utility regulatory law, the public utility stuff I just mentioned with respect to infrastructure. If a state has transportation policy that's trying to drive down vehicle miles traveled or stimulate electrical vehicle infrastructure, all that remains in place. If a state has carbon pricing, That remains in place. The state could adjust it as it wants to, but that remains in place if they have renewable portfolio standards. And then one here that is, I think maybe has caught some people's attention is nuisance law. So this comes up quite a, this question comes up in a few places, but a couple of states have statutory law that gives, in California in particular, it gives the counties and municipalities the right to bring public nuisance lawsuits. And these are the lawsuits that the California counties are bringing against the big greenhouse gas emitters. So those stay in place also. It also includes any transportation and infrastructure policy, zoning, building codes, highway construction, all of that stuff. And then also remaining in place is California's Clean Air Act 209 waiver for automobiles. So California retains explicit authority to implement its own standards for automobiles. Section 8, and here's the stuff that does get paused. And here's the language that does this. It's section 303A of the Energy Act. And I've highlighted here a couple of words here. And so one of the words I've highlighted is limiting. So it's got to be a rule of the administrative agency that limits the emissions of greenhouse gases from the combustion of that fuel. And then some other language I've highlighted here at the very end is on the basis of the emissions greenhouse gas effects. And then another part of this is a conditional, which is if the carbon fee is imposed by section 9902 or 9908, then the regulatory pause happens. So the pause is conditional. It is limited. It is targeted to those regulations which limit or could limit emissions, but it's also confined to the greenhouse gas effect of the emission. So let's see how that language plays out with respect to some specific regulations. So first of all, EPA authority over criteria pollutants is untouched. All right, so I think this is an important, and I can be, I'm happy to be unambiguous about this. Sometimes it might be this way, it might be that way, but if you have friends who are worried about clean air and the public health of air, you can say, after you tell them what a criteria pollutant is, but you can say all of those pollutants that give you asthma or lung disease, all those pollutants can still be regulated by the EPA. There's also another category in here, which is the hazardous air pollutants. Those are also untouched. So both hazardous air pollutants and criteria pollutants, EPA's authority over those are untouched. And you can say that and feel unambiguous and confident about that. And the items, the regulations that the EPA has issued that will be subject to a pause are a Title V prevention of significant deterioration rules. But what this would require is it would require states in their state implementation plan to include what end up being facility level efficiency standards, for new sources in particular areas of the country. Section 11B, these are the new source performance standards for energy generating units. So just to recall, those new source performance standards prior to the Trump administration's reworking of them would have required, would have allowed natural gas fired plants. It would have allowed coal fired plants only if they also had carbon capture and sequestration on them. So 11B is placed under pause by the Energy Innovation Act. And Section 11D is existing sources. And that is the Clean Power Plan, which is now morphed into America's Clean Energy Plan or something like this. But we'll do an analysis of the Clean Power Plan since that is the most aggressive potential replacement of EPA authority. And then one thing that there's no regulation of, which the Energy Innovation Act does prohibit is no federal low carbon fuel standard. So California has a low carbon fuel standard, which requires that blenders in the state have petroleum products which meet a certain emission standard that was articulated in grams of carbon per energy unit, per megajoule, I believe. And the EPA under the Energy Innovation Act is prohibited from creating a low carbon fuel standard. So those are the one, two, three, four, the four things that seem to be the most significant regulations which are paused. This is the language which allows for the EPA to continue to regulate the greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. So that is retained. And then, so all of those regulations are, we're calling it a pause, and I think that's an accurate description. And that is because in the year 2030, the bill requires that the EPA basically take a step back and go, are the emissions from covered fuels, which are priced, are they actually being mitigated and reduced in a way that meets the standards in the bill? So the Energy Innovation Act sets emission reduction targets. And the way the pause works is if in 2030, the carbon fee hasn't met those targets, then EPA authority kicks back in. And one interesting thing about the regulatory pause language allowing for EPA authority to kick back in is it makes the EPA's authority over greenhouse gases less ambiguous than that authority under Massachusetts versus EPA. So you're going to see here in a couple slides, even though carbon dioxide and methane are a pollutant for purposes of the Clean Air Act, there are a lot of places where the EPA has to kind of tiptoe around the regulatory language in order to try to make the regulations match up with the statutory authority. And that kind of ambiguity is cleaned up in the Energy Innovation Act if the carbon price does not meet the mitigation targets. Create the mitigation required by the emission targets. All right, so I wanted to go through an exercise here where we looked at how, you know, when we're making a judgment about which of those regulations are redundant or complementary to a carbon pricing. So what's one framework for doing this? And just last week, our good friends Justin Gundlach, Ron Minsk, and Noah Kaufman set out a paper from the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy, kind of setting out this framework. And they asked the question, all right, well, let's look at the relationship between carbon pricing and these other regulations, and let's ask if those regulations are complementary to or redundant of a carbon price. And their criteria for complementary is a policy is complementary when it enables more cost-effective mitigation in conjunction with a carbon price. So for instance, they point out when there are other market failures that are not corrected by the carbon price and need other corrections. And then another thing that might make a policy complementary is when that policy achieves a separate objective besides mitigation. So it might reduce local pollution in one area or another. So that's their criteria for complementary. And if it's not complementary, then the policy could be redundant. That is, we don't need the policy at all. Or it could be contrary, which is the policy could actually be getting in the way of mitigation. So what I wanted to do is take us through the Clean Power Plan and to just do a fairly granular analysis of how that plan worked in the past tense. But this framework is what a lot of people seem to be hoping for might be reinstated. So the Clean Air Act language off of which the EPA has to key off of in determining what kind of regulations it can pass here with respect to existing sources. So the regulations have to be on a system of emission reduction. They have to be adequately demonstrated. They have to be the best considering cost and energy requirements, and those regulations have to be achievable So that's a lot of stuff. And the Clean Power Plan has three building blocks that it thinks, that the EPA thought was a system of emission reductions that that were adequately demonstrated to achieve emission reductions at a cost, under cost requirements. I'm sorry, energy requirements that are not costly. So the first of those blocks was the heat rate improvement, and that ends up being facility level efficiency for coal-fired facilities. So coal has an energy content, and when you burn it, that energy content is transferred into heat. So the heat rate improvement is basically making that combustion process more efficient. The second block of the Clean Power Plan was running existing natural gas more often. So natural gas has an emission rate that's about half that of coal per unit of energy. So half the amount of carbon dioxide is emitted for the same amount of energy generated. So if you switch your generating over to natural gas, you reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the third is relying upon or building more renewable energy generation. So this is like switching to natural gas generation, except you're switching from coal generation to renewable energy generation. This last building block is user side efficiency. And I put a little star here because it wasn't included in the final plan. It was part of the initial proposal, but almost everybody thought that user-side efficiency would fall to an ultra-vires challenge. That is, it is beyond the EPA's Clean Air Act authority to incentivize or require user-side efficiency. And I highlight this one because user-side efficiency is the most cost-effective way to mitigate. So this is kind of the thing you want to do first. It's already economic to do energy side efficiency, and you get mitigation on it. So this is one of the drawbacks and one of the shortcomings of the architecture of the Clean Air Act. The most economically efficient thing you can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions cannot be done by the Clean Air Act. And so there was an earlier question about clarifying regulatory authority. I think this is one of the areas that might get clarified. Here's the other area where this might be clarified. The Clean Power Plan was challenged. These three building blocks, the challenge was basically the Clean Air Act only allows the EPA to do the first of these, heat rate improvements. So that was the main pith of the ultra-vires challenge. The Trump administration was basically is now, the people now running the EPA were running that litigation, not just in spirit, but sometimes literally. And so the new affordable clean energy regulations out of the Wheeler administration regulations here, just the heat rate improvements. And so another way in which the kickback of regulatory authority happens is the ambiguity as to which of these building blocks might be authorized under the Clean Air Act, that ambiguity is removed. So hopefully that helps with the question about what ambiguity is removed. And let's just run through those three building blocks with respect to Kaufman's criteria of complementary. So heat rate intensity, this is most likely redundant. So the carbon fee will make coal more expensive. And so coal-fired generating units will want to use that coal more efficiently. So the carbon fee probably induces facility level efficiency programs. So probably redundant. The next block here is natural gas switching. Again, most likely redundant. Natural gas has a lower carbon intensity than coal, so a carbon fee should induce fuel switching to natural gas. And just an interesting tidbit here, in the wholesale markets for electrical power, about $42 a ton, which is the social cost of carbon by some measures, that doubles the price of energy in the wholesale markets from coal. So what I think most people on this line consider to be a fairly low carbon price will whack coal off the grid. I think, pretty confident. All right, third block of the Clean Power Plan, generating, switching to renewables. Again, most likely redundant. All right, so carbon fee will price fossil fuels, both the both coal and natural gas, and those renewables will become more competitive and will displace the generation from natural gas and coal. So it looks like to me that a carbon fee is redundant to the three elements of the Clean Power Plan. And I just want to run through some examples here of non-Clean Air Act policies and do a quick example of thinking through whether or not those are complementary or redundant. So PACE is Property Assessed Clean Energy. This allows the owner of the clean energy unit, say a solar on my roof, to basically build the pricing of that into my property taxes. So I might pay back for my solar installation rather than one big chunk of money to the solar installer. I pay it through my taxes. This is probably complementary because what that will do, it will reduce the rate of capital needed for installing solar projects. And it also, I think one really cool thing about it is it makes it so that if I install the solar on my house, then when I sell it down the line, the new owner not only gets the benefit of the power generated by the solar, but they also take up the cost and the liability of it. So it's a way to build into the value of the property the value of those generating assets. So PACE is probably complementary. What's our next example here? Appliance efficiency. This is also complementary in that appliances have a weird feature, which is they're subject to split incentives. And that is in the case where the you have a landlord-renter relationship. And it doesn't matter how the ownership relationship plays out. If the landlord owns the appliance, the renter might be paying the bill, and so neither of those individuals have the incentive or the means to install the most efficient energy appliance. So that's called split incentives. The cost of energy inefficiency of an appliance is not felt by one person. It's felt by two people. So appliance efficiency is probably complementary to a carbon price since it solves a different market failure than carbon pricing. And our third example of a conflicting regulatory piece of the puzzle is something called master limited partnerships. And this is it's a type of corporate form. And what it does is it gives a special taxing status to these partnerships with respect to different types of projects. And in particular, these projects are listed. And almost all those projects have to do with petroleum infrastructure. So a lot of the natural gas and petroleum pipelines are owned by master limited partnerships, and the special taxing structure of those means that capital is incentivized to invest in those infrastructure projects. So as defined, those are probably conflicting. And just to give you an idea of what some advocates would like to do here is change the master limited partnerships to include green energy projects and maybe removing the petroleum projects from that list. All right, so there's a lot of little pieces to fool around with in there. All right, so I'll just run through this. Brett and I and Allison have a project. We run a climate policy camp June 5th through 7th, and we have experts from around the country come in and get into the nitty-gritty details, not just of carbon pricing, but of other aspects of climate policy. Justin Gunlax to negotiate a carbon tax is a wonderful piece if you want to look into this further. And then David Bookbinder, the wonderful lawyer at the Niskanen Center, gave a talk at the 2017 conference. So you can jump in on that. It's on YouTube. All right, for final takeaways, Clean Air Act remains the law of the land. It is the foundational EPA authority over greenhouse gases, confirmed by the Supreme Court's Massachusetts versus EPA ruling in 2007. The Energy Innovation Act keeps that foundational ruling in place. The Energy Innovation Act would limit three mechanisms, the 111D, the Clean Power Plan, and its successor, the American Clean Energy Plan. It would affect the permitting rules for new industrial emitting sites, the new source performance standards, and it would limit, it would pause Title V PSD. PSD is prevention of significant deterioration permitting rules for new and modified plants. And then if targets are not met after 10 years, by 2030, EPA authority over greenhouse authority is kicked in. The fee ratchets up as our targets are not met. And then the Academy Science studies are the main mechanism by which we will be judging the effectiveness of the carbon fee against potential regulatory powers.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Reminder for those of you that haven't been yet or would like to share the news about the policy camp this summer. It's going to be right before the national conference in DC at American University. It's got some wonderful faculty that are being drawn from throughout the country. We would absolutely love to have you join us. There's a lot of effort being put in and a lot of great experiences that come out of it. With that, if you have any questions, please feel free to email me after tonight. My email is listed here, as well as posing questions on the Energy Innovation Act forum on Community. Those are going to be the best two places for you to find out more information. That forum is just cclusa.org/energy-innovation-act-forum. And at this point, we'll just give a huge round of applause again for all of the help and insight tonight, Ross. We really, really appreciate your time walking us through the thorough details, helping us understand this interaction more. We hope that you found tonight's webinar useful and addressed the questions that you came curious about. If not, please let us know how we can further clarify it.